As spring warms up the Rocky Mountains, this is Go West Young Podcast, the show all about the outdoors and America's public lands. In a minute, we will hear from law professor Mark Squillaci. He is the guy you want to talk to about the legal history of public lands and natural resources. We will get his take on the Trump administration, the one bill that really scares him in Congress right now, and a fellow Coloradan, Neil Gorsuch, being considered for the Supreme Court. And we will look back at a legendary life, the soldier, scientist, and explorer John Wesley Powell, this week in Western history. My name is Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver, Colorado. Thank you for downloading us this week. First up, let's talk about what's making news on our public lands. President Trump released his budget proposal, and our parks do not fare well under it. The president wants to see a 12% cut at the Department of the Interior. Included in that is a evisceration, really, of the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which is arguably America's most important parks program. That fund, which is known around here as LWCF, is what lets the Park Service and other agencies buy inholdings, those privately owned land within our national parks. When a landowner wants to sell, it is the only option that the government has for acquiring land in order to make a national park whole. So without LWCF, a landowner who needs to sell for financial reasons has to head to the open market, which opens the door to trophy homes in our national parks. President Trump wants to take that money and instead divert it to the National Park Maintenance Backlog, which on the face of it may sound like a good idea, but when you look at what's actually going on here, it starts to smell like a giant giveaway to his friends in the hotel industry. You see, the park's backlog adds up to $12 billion on paper, but a whole lot of that is roads. Those roads need to get fixed, but they are usually funded through transportation bills, not the regular interior budget. And the backlog also includes hundreds of millions of dollars in maintenance that is supposed to be paid for by hotel owners and concession companies that operate in our national parks. When they don't do the maintenance, it goes on the parks backlog, because ultimately taxpayers are responsible for our national parks. So we looked at the backlog, we dug in there and found nearly $400 million in private maintenance projects spread across 72 national park units. By diverting money away from land acquisition, President Trump is proposing a giveaway to hotel companies and multi-billion dollar concession corporations that aren't paying their bills. Let's look at Yellowstone specifically. On paper, you see $630 million in back maintenance. The Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke even tweeted out that number last week when he was at Yellowstone. But when you take away all those concession projects and paved roads, only a quarter of it should actually come out of the regular Park Service budget, and less than 6% of it is considered critical deferred maintenance. $35 million out of that $630 million total. Should that critical maintenance happen? Absolutely. But in the grand scheme of the federal budget, $35 million is a totally manageable number. There is no reason to gut funding to the rest of our parks and public lands while at the same time helping out hotel owners to pay for that backlog. All right, you can see a map of that private maintenance backlog at all the parks at westernpriorities.org or on our Medium blog, medium.com/westwise. And one other note, in his first week on the job, Interior Secretary Zinke promised to fight to fund his department. Looking at the president's budget, it is safe to say Ryan Zinke lost that fight. Our guest this week is Mark Squillaci, professor at the University of Colorado Law School. He is the author of countless books and papers on natural resources and environmental law. He also worked with former Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt on a wide range of policy and legal issues toward the tail end of the Clinton administration. Professor Squillaci, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Aaron. Glad to be here.
I want to start with the Antiquities Act. It's certainly at the top of mind right now because of bear's ears. Utah's congressional delegation insists that if the Antiquities Act gives the president the power to create a national monument, it must also therefore give the president the power to erase one. Is that true?
Almost certainly not, or at least the current law that we have suggests that it's not. It's an interesting sort of story because the authority to make decisions regarding public lands comes from the property clause of the Constitution, and it essentially gives the full power, what the Supreme Court has has claimed is power without limitations to the Congress. So the Congress gets to decide how to manage our public lands, and Congress, of course, can delegate some of that power to the executive branch. Sometimes Congress has granted to executive branch officials the power to withdraw lands for particular purposes. And in granting that authority, sometimes it is allowed the president or some other executive branch official to modify those withdrawals or to revoke them. And so we have examples from other law where Congress has indeed granted broad powers to create or revoke or modify these kinds of withdrawals. The Antiquities Act is interesting and somewhat unique because it grants what I consider to be really one-way withdrawal authority. It empowers the president to proclaim and reserve national monuments that contain objects of scientific and historic interest, but not to modify or revoke those. And there's an opinion from the Attorney General of the United States from 1938 that I think does a pretty good job of analyzing this question and essentially takes the position that based upon these other laws that I mentioned previously, that the Antiquities Act gives the president only the authority to proclaim or reserve national monuments and not the power to revoke them.
And I suppose then the other important part of that that you mentioned is modify. So with Rob Bishop saying that the president could, if he wanted, shrink Bear's ears by 10, 50, 90%. You, that as well, you think, would end up getting challenged and probably tossed out?
One could make an argument that some previous president did not limit the proclamation to the smallest area compatible as required by the Antiquities Act. I personally think that that would require that the previous president made essentially a mistake of fact, because these kinds of proclamations involve judgment calls that one president makes. And if the president has designated or set aside a particular area because he thought that that particular area contained these objects of scientific or historic interest, then I don't think it would be reasonable to suggest that some other president could come along and essentially take a different view. If, however, there was a mistake of fact, if a president had set aside an area thinking that a particular object was within that area and it was not, then it seems to me that kind of mistake of fact might be grounds for modifying a monument. Short of that, however, I don't think that you can distinguish the modification issue from the revocation issue.
So you're a student of history as much as law then. How unprecedented would it be if President Trump tried something like that, either rescinding or shrinking? And how would that end up playing out, do you think, in the courts?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting question, Aaron, because we do actually have some experience with presidents modifying proclamations that were designated by prior presidents. And what we can say is that none of these changes were challenged in the courts. And so we don't know how a court might view such a decision. The most famous of the modifications that we've seen happened way back, I think around 1915, by Woodrow Wilson. It was a modification of the what was then called the Mount Olympus National Monument, what is now the Olympic National Park in the state of Washington. The original monument had been proclaimed by Teddy Roosevelt. It included something like 600,000 acres of land in what is now the Olympic National Park. There was a lot of pressure on Woodrow Wilson to reduce the size of that monument, really because of the mining and timber interests that were in that area. And Wilson did so. He cut the monument pretty much in half as a result of this pressure that he received from the mining and logging industries. And the environmental community was quite upset with the decision by Wilson, but they never challenged that decision in court. So we don't really know how a court might view it. Obviously, it was a controversial kind of decision, and at least it gives some kind of precedent. What I would say, though, is that's the classic case where it doesn't seem to me to fit within the scope of the authority granted under the Antiquities Act. There is a second example, probably the other largest example of a modification came More recently, I think it was Franklin Roosevelt that reduced the size of the Grand Canyon National Monument, again, a monument that had originally been proclaimed by Teddy Roosevelt. And it was a somewhat more modest reduction. I think it involved about 70,000 acres of land that was taken out of the Grand Canyon National Monument. And once again, that decision seemed to be done at the behest of not concerns about whether or not the objects were needed to be protected, but rather the grazing interests in the area that did not want those lands included within the monument. So those are just two examples where I do not think the modifications were made consistent with the terms of the Antiquities Act. And had either of those decisions been challenged, it would have been interesting to see whether the court might have reversed on the grounds that the president lacked the authority to carry out those modifications.
So the bottom line, you think that the strongest or possibly only valid case for shrinking a monument would be a mistake of fact, that the president thought he was including something that was not actually in the monument?
Or, yeah, that's exactly right.
I want to take a step back, talk about something that we see all the time on Facebook threads on our page. We see these folks who insist that the federal government can't own land. Cliven Bundy and his sons, they're about to stand trial in Nevada. Cliven famously rejected the right of the federal government to even exist. His followers almost all deny that it's constitutional for the federal government to own land or as much land as the American people do today. What does the Constitution actually say about land ownership?
Well, again, this all traces back to the Property Clause of the Constitution, which, as I said, the Supreme Court has interpreted to give the Congress what they describe as plenary authority, or authority without limitations, essentially to manage our public lands. There doesn't seem to be any basis for these claims that somehow these lands should be turned over to the states, or that the federal government is obliged to turn these lands over to the states. Certainly Congress has that power. Congress could on its own decide to basically turn the lands over to the states, and on occasion with relatively small parcels, the Congress has done so. And so this notion that somehow Utah and other states thought they were entitled to claim these lands that were clearly part of the federal public domain is just, it seems to me, wrong. And these states agreed to allow the federal government to keep those lands.
And with the Enabling Acts, where the people of each state forever disclaim any claim to those lands, was there ever a timeline either explicitly or implicitly spelled out for when the federal government would hand over the rest of the public lands within the state?
Absolutely not. There's language that suggests that the federal government essentially maintains control over those lands unless and until they're disposed of. And I think the state of Utah has tried to claim that somehow that implies that the government was obliged to dispose of those lands. But there's no real indication that that was the intention of that language. And indeed, the word disposed does not necessarily connote that kind of result for those lands.
Sure. So the Chris Ann Halls and the Alex Joneses of the world like to point to something different. The Enclave Clause in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 18, Clause 17, that's the one that mentions forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, other needful buildings as proof that the federal government can't own other land other than these enclaves. Has that, I assume, been litigated at some point, or is that just not even relevant?
Well, I don't see how that's relevant. I mean, again, you can't just look at the Enclave Clause in isolation when you have a separate important clause in the Constitution that specifically grants to the Congress the authority to manage the public lands. And as I've noted, the Supreme Court has passed on the Property Clause on numerous occasions and has been quite explicit about the breadth of a federal authority over public lands. And there's been no indication whatsoever in any of these decisions that somehow the federal government's authority over the public lands is somehow compromised or limited by the Enclave Clause. Quite the contrary. As I said earlier, Probably the most famous of these decisions, at least recent decisions, is a case called United States versus Mexico, in which the Supreme Court made clear that the government's power over public lands is essentially without limitations.
So then by that notion, then any 10th Amendment arguments that these folks make, that any powers not granted explicitly in the Constitution fall to the states, the 10th Amendment doesn't come into play because you have the Article 4 property clause.
That's correct.
Okay. Do you think it would be a good thing maybe if one of these cases went back to the Supreme Court just so, you know, they could get slapped down again with yet another definitive statement from the Supreme Court that yes, it is constitutional for the American people and the federal government to own land?
Well, it strikes me as somewhat unproductive to have the courts have to pass on these issues. I suppose as long as states continue to want to make these kinds of arguments, maybe it's best if we let the courts pass on them. But it's very high profile litigation. It I think to some extent tends to fuel these controversies that you mentioned earlier. The sort of Bundy arguments and those kinds of things seem to me to get some energy from these kinds of lawsuits that are sometimes filed. And I just don't think that's particularly productive to sort of raise the level of the controversy of these issues. These are really fringe arguments. These are not, to my mind, serious legal arguments that these folks are making. And I think it'd be best if they, frankly, just dropped these claims.
Is there anyone in the serious legal community? Are there any established law professors making counterarguments to this? Or is it really truly just the Alex Jones, Chris Ann Hall fringes of the world?
Well, you know, I mean, the state of Utah, I think, has been sort of leading an effort to try to find legal arguments. They've appropriated a fair amount of money and hired a law firm to help them construct arguments. And there are arguments out there that I suppose you would have to say are being made by serious lawyers. But they're serious lawyers who are essentially being paid to make a particular argument. And frankly, I don't think the arguments that they've come up with are particularly compelling. You know, I suppose you can get a lawyer to argue any point of view. That's the nature of our legal process here in the United States. But I don't know that necessarily translates into legitimate or appropriate kinds of arguments. And this is just not one of those issues that strikes me as one where there's a lot of serious debate.
You're not seeing law review articles from the great legal minds of our era saying that Supreme Court got this wrong for 185 years.
No, I don't see a serious argument on the side of the states in this particular case.
Speaking of big legal minds, I want to ask about Neil Gorsuch, President Trump's Supreme Court nominee. He was a judge here in Colorado on the 10th Circuit. The Associated Press recently looked at his record on public lands, and the AP's bottom line was that Gorsuch showed, quote, a willingness to limit the participation of environmental groups in public lands lawsuits. What's your read on his nomination and any cases that he's ruled on that you've have particularly caught your eye?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. First of all, he strikes me as a very serious person. He writes beautifully. I would be the first to concede that he's a brilliant legal scholar and writer. And from that perspective, I think he certainly meets the minimum qualifications for a justice on the Supreme Court. What makes this nomination, I think, so difficult was the way that Merrick Garland's nomination was handled. And so it's become a much more political kind of decision than these kinds of decisions probably ought to be. Having said that, I don't think we have a very good read yet on how a Justice Gorsuch might behave once he got to the Supreme Court. There has been a fair amount of commentary sort of characterizing him as a very conservative judge. If he were approved, some say he would be one of the most conservative judges, maybe the most conservative judge on the U.S. Supreme Court. And I don't think we can say that with any certainty at this point. I think we need to let this play out. One of the more interesting opinions that he wrote that actually got quite a bit of attention before he was ever nominated to the Supreme Court was an opinion involving an issue of deference to government agencies and the so-called Chevron doctrine. So under Chevron, a case that was decided many years ago, I think it was in the early to mid-1980s, that the Supreme Court ruled in the Chevron case, they essentially held that when an agency is interpreting a statute, courts should generally defer to the agency's interpretation of the statute as long as it presented kind of a reasonable sort of position. And under the doctrine, it doesn't necessarily have to be the interpretation that the court would have given it if it had been ruling on the interpretation of the statute in the first instance. It can be any reasonable interpretation. And it's a little more complicated because he was particularly concerned about a later case that it was applying Chevron in a somewhat different context. We call it the Brand X case. And what happened in Brand X was that there was an interpretation by an agency that went counter to a prior judicial opinion. The earlier judicial opinion had been rendered at a time when the agency hadn't actually promulgated a rule or interpreted the statute, so the court interpreted the statute in the first instance. And then the agency came along and essentially wrote a rule that disagreed with the court's decision. And in Brand X, the Supreme Court essentially allowed the new agency interpretation to prevail over the earlier court interpretation. And Judge Gorsuch was particularly critical of this application of the Chevron doctrine and raised some questions about whether or not Chevron is an appropriate approach to take to interpretation of statutes by agencies. I think it's a really interesting legal question. I think some people feel that the Chevron doctrine is so embedded in our law that it would be somewhat disastrous to overturn it at this stage. I'm not quite sure it's as important as some people see it, and it would certainly be a change in the way that we look at the law. But there's always going to be some level of deference, if you will, to agency decisions, if for no other reason than the agency is offering an explanation for why they are doing what they're doing, and courts will look at that explanation, and if they think it's compelling, they are likely to defer to it, irrespective of whether we have a formal kind of Chevron doctrine. But it's something that a lot of folks are watching because it's one particular opinion where Judge Gorsuch has really stepped out a little bit from sort of the traditional views.
Fascinating. I want to bring it back to public lands for one last question. This is more of a big picture one. We've seen the Trump administration already start repealing rules left and right, trying to gut the EPA budget. What kind of legal strategies do you think we're going to see from conservation groups in the coming months and years? What does the landscape legally suddenly look like in this new world?
I think if I had to say there was one important fight that we ought to be waging, it's over these proposals to fundamentally change the administrative state. Because in the end, I think these are the kinds of things that could have the most long-lasting impacts on things like our public lands and our environment.
And I know you're very concerned about something called the RAINS Act. I think that's probably not on most people's radar. What is that?
Regulations of the Executive in Need of Scrutiny Act. So it's Regulations of the Executive in Need of Scrutiny, R-E-I-N-S. And it's this sort of somewhat obscure law that has already passed the House of Representatives, is now pending in the Senate. If it were to pass the Senate, it would almost certainly be signed by President Trump. And what's shocking about this law is that it would require that all major regulations going forward essentially be passed by Congress or they don't go into effect. And we all know how difficult it is to get anything through Congress and how easy it is for any party to block getting things through Congress. And so this could very well be the end of major regulations if this law were to pass. But it gets worse because there are two other provisions that I think people really aren't paying attention to. One of them is described in the statute or the bill as a cut-go provision, and it's related to a provision that Trump put in one of his executive orders. Under the cut-go provision, if an agency promulgates a new rule, it has to offset the cost of the new rule by repealing one or more other rules that the agency has promulgated. And what's really, I think, concerning about this provision, I mean, there are a lot of things that concern me about it, it's that you only look at the cost of these rules. You don't look at the benefits. So it may be that the rules that you're repealing have benefits that vastly exceed the costs, But you don't look at that. You only look at the cost of the new rule and the cost of the old rule that you're repealing, and then you have to make those decisions before you can put forth the new rule. And then the final part of the RAINS Act, and in many ways this is absolutely the worst part of it, it is this provision that essentially says that over a 10-year period, each agency has to present to the Congress 10% of all their rules. So over this 10-year period, all of the agency's rules will have to go through the Congress. And those rules essentially are going to expire unless Congress affirmatively passes them. And for all the reasons I've already mentioned, the chances of Congress passing any rule that has any controversy associated with it, I think, are slim to none. You know, Steve Bannon, in his speech to the CPAC, suggested that the Trump administration is intent upon deconstructing the administrative state. If this law were to pass, I think he would realize that result. I think the sort of administrative state as we know it today would essentially be gone. And the whole notion of agencies engaged in protecting the public interest and protecting public resources in the way that they have historically done, I think that's gone.
And it seems like then the other effect of that then is that it essentially turns Congress into micromanagers. I mean, is that what we elect members of Congress to do?
And Congress is just not equipped to do that. I mean, there's a reason that we've seen this growth in the executive branch of government. It's because, you know, at least since the progressive era, in Teddy Roosevelt's day, and certainly through the New Deal, we recognize the importance of having experts in charge of trying to administer government agencies, people who understood the issues that they were charged with managing and regulating, promulgating rules and taking other actions that reflected their expertise. And Congress, even the best of any congressman, they don't have the capacity to know these issues in the kind of detail that agencies have to know them. And so you're really putting on the Congress an impossible task. And as I said, at the end of the day, because Congress is this deliberative body with made up of so many different members, you're not really going to get anything through. Because we know that in our Congress, with our checks and balances system of government, it's so much easier to block things than it is to get anything passed. It's hard for me to even imagine what the world looks like 10 years after a law like this were to pass.
It is, I suppose, nihilism in that way, and maybe that is some of the goal here. Anything else?
I think that's exactly the goal.
Anything else that you're facing right now in either public lands, environmental law that's caught your eye you want to mention before we go?
Sure. I mean, you know, we haven't talked at all about mineral development on public lands, in particular fossil fuel resources. And I know that Ryan Zinke said some positive things about retaining public lands and public ownership. I think many of us who support that idea were pleased by those comments. But others have raised concerns about Zinke's track record regarding fossil fuels, and the rumors are he's about to issue some sort of order rescinding the moratorium or pause, as Secretary Jewell called it, on coal leasing, federal coal leasing. And I think that's really a shame. I think those of us who have been following the coal leasing issue in particular know that the coal leasing system is fundamentally broken. It took years and years for us to persuade the Interior Department that they needed to take another look at the coal leasing program to try to bring some integrity to that program. And it seems like that's not going to happen, or at least the moratorium on coal leasing that was put in place while they studied the issue is going to be gone. I'm hopeful, and there are early signs that it might happen, that the Zinke administration is going to continue to move forward with the programmatic EIS on the coal leasing program. So at least, hopefully, we can still get some needed reforms out of that system. But I think taking away the moratorium is a mistake. There's more than 20 years of federal coal already under lease, and demand is continuing to decline for federal coal. It doesn't make any sense, to my mind, to continue to lease those lands for coal. And then the other issue that's going to be interesting to watch is oil and gas development on public lands. The BLM just fairly recently issued two important sets of regulations, one dealing with fracking on public lands, another dealing with methane emissions. on public lands, and both of those are in litigation right now. The methane rules were promulgated fairly recently and have been caught up in this Congressional Review Act process, and the House has already passed a resolution repealing the methane rule. The Senate has not yet made a decision on whether they're going to go along with the House for repealing that rule, but if they do, then President Trump is expected to sign that legislation. And I think that's really unfortunate. These are two, I think, sensible regulations that really do a lot, not only to protect our public lands, but in the case of the methane rule, to secure appropriate revenues from the sale of our public lands, or excuse me, our public land resources. And we would lose that if they repeal this methane rule. So that's a really unfortunate thing, but it's also another thing that we should watch closely. I'm still hopeful that maybe the Senate will take a pass on repealing this methane rule, but that's one to watch.
I'm going to ask you to maybe step outside your comfort zone, take off your law hat, put on your economist hat when it comes to coal.
Uh-oh.
Then is there, let's say the government opened the floodgates on coal leasing tomorrow, is there a market left given the costs now of bringing online solar and wind power that's so cheap and natural gas? Is there anything at this point that would make a serious dent or a serious change in coal production on federal lands, considering the broader energy markets?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, right? I mean, so if you ask the coal industry, they're all optimistic about a resurgence in interest in coal, partly because of the talk of the Trump administration trying to sort of end the so-called war on coal and bring coal back. I frankly don't think that there's anything to these claims. Coal is not the energy of the future. I mean, I think there's some interesting things happening with coal research. There's a proposal right now up in Wyoming that is looking at turning coal into carbon fiber. And so it's not using coal for thermal electric production, but rather to turn it into some more useful types of products. I think we're still pretty much in the R&D phase of those kinds of technologies. I certainly think it's worth looking carefully at those kinds of options, and that could certainly provide some market for additional coal resources. But the idea that coal is going to be a significant part of our energy future seems not realistic to me. Certainly, it for the time being, it's still a significant part of our electric production, but it continues to decline. I mean, just a week or two ago, we learned that the Navajo Generating Station down in Page, Arizona, is likely to close in a few years. That was a real shock to many of us because it just didn't seem like that plant was going to close in quite a long time. It had been scheduled, I think, to stay open until 2044.
Yeah,
and so the idea that it's going to close now in 2019 is fairly shocking, and it signals that the coal markets and the coal industry has not really changed in a significant way, notwithstanding some of the promises of the Trump administration. I just don't see these trends changing. For all the reasons that you pointed out with renewable energy and for the cheap price of natural gas, it seems to me that the declining trend in coal is going to continue. If the federal government were to try to lease additional coal, they would attract these very tiny bids for our federal coal resources, and that just doesn't seem like a good idea, particularly given the challenge of climate change that we're now facing.
All right. Mark Squillaci is a professor of law at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Thank you so much for this fascinating conversation and your time on the podcast today.
All right, Aaron. Good to talk with you.
We always wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. Today, we are celebrating the birthday of a soldier, teacher, explorer, and scientist who shaped the West in the 1800s, John Wesley Powell. He was born this week in 1834 in Palmyra, New York. He lost his right arm below the elbow in the Civil War, went back, re-enlisted, continued to fight in the war, by the way, through the end. He was a science teacher before and after the war when he started leading expeditions to the West to explore the geology of the Rockies. In 1869, he became the first white man to float down the Grand Canyon. 2 years later, He won a government grant to map the Colorado Plateau. His descriptions of the region created an entirely new branch of geology known as geomorphology. In 1881, he became the director of the U.S. Geological Survey, turning the agency into the scientific powerhouse that it remains to this day. His insistence on putting science ahead of politics did earn him plenty of enemies. He was forced out after about 13 years running USGS. As early as the 1880s, he was warning that America was on course for years of legal fights over water rights. Those warnings went unheeded until the Dust Bowl years in the 20s and 30s, long after his death. John Wesley Powell's legacy can be found across the West today, from Lake Powell on the Colorado River, to a rock formation known as Powell's Profile in the Glen Canyon National Recreation Area, even a rare mineral called powellite. John Wesley Powell, born this week in 1834. That's it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. You know, I was talking to someone in D.C. the other day. They mentioned they met someone at a party who said that they were obsessed with this podcast. Thank you, I think, to whoever you are, our dear obsessed listener. Whether you are obsessed or upset at anything we say here, please drop us an email, podcast@westernpriorities.org. And please, if you haven't yet, head on over to iTunes. Leave us a review. It makes us feel good. More importantly, it helps new listeners discover the podcast. On behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, my name is Aaron Weiss, and thanks for listening.